So let me describe for you what I want to do. I want to describe for all of us the landscape of the workplace and how discrimination and religious liberty issues play out in that landscape. And I want to talk about a Supreme Court case that was decided in March of this year, the Abercrombie case, because it's a case about religious discrimination in the workplace. And I want to do all of that in about the first 25 or 30 minutes, and then I want to leave the last half hour for you to ask me questions, for us to talk about some hypothetical situations, and talk with each other about how they might be resolved. All right? Now, my focus is going to be primarily on the workplace as it applies to the private sector as opposed to the public sector. So let me begin by saying, in the private sector, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits a series of discriminations, and one of them is religious discrimination. I want to say that that prohibition is subject to two exceptions. One of the exceptions is a statutory exception. That's a religious organization exception. So religious organizations can prefer members of their own faith in terms of hiring, and they do not run afoul of the discrimination provisions which prohibit religious discrimination. The other exception comes out of the First Amendment, and it is a ministerial exception which permits religious faiths to hire individuals who are members of that religious faith as ministers. Now, I want to talk just briefly. Title VII speaks to the theories under which discrimination is brought. It talks about accommodation. It talks about harassment. And it talks about retaliation. So let me just briefly outline those for you. There are two theories under which a lawsuit can be brought alleging religious discrimination. One of those theories is disparate treatment. And in everyday conversation, what that means is you treat people differently because of their religion. That's disparate treatment. Disparate treatment is an inquiry into what the motives of the employer were, either at the hiring stage or the promotion stage or the firing stage, and if the motive was a religious motive, then we have disparate treatment. The other theory is disparate impact. Disparate impact is not interested in the motive of the employer. What you do under disparate impact is look and see if there are statistical differences in the workplace based on religion, and if so, then there's an inference that there's been discrimination, and so these kinds of lawsuits are all about statistical analysis. Religious harassment is prohibited under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. A balance is sought here in terms of harassment, because it is understood that there will be discussions within the workplace with respect to religion, and those kinds of discussions do not rise to the level of constituting harassment. But if I am an adherent of a particular religious faith and you are not, and our conversation is one in which you feel that I am exhibiting hostility towards you, or I'm making your life in the workplace unhealthy, unfriendly, then I've engaged in harassment. And my employer is responsible for that harassment. All right? And the responsibility that the employer has is if the employer becomes aware of my harassment of this employee, The employer needs to talk to me and tell me to desist and to talk to the person who feels like they've been harassed and saying, I've spoken to this person, he will cease doing that. You be in touch with me and tell me if he's abiding by this. If so, then the harassment goes away. All right? So that's the claim of harassment. Another concept is retaliation. And by the way, let me stop for a minute. The harasser could be a supervisor. The harasser could be a coworker. The harasser could even be somebody in the workplace who isn't an employee. And the employer has some degree of responsibility in each of those three different settings. Obviously, the most important responsibility is if the harasser is a supervisor. Okay? But it is present even if it is a coworker who is doing the harasser. So instead of me being your supervisor and you my underling, you and I are employees similarly situated, and I'm harassing you. Is the employer responsible? And the answer is yes. And you're an employee and I am a customer and I walk in off the street and begin to harass you. Does the employer potentially have some liability even in that setting? And the answer is yes. So harassment, okay? An area of employment law that has grown exponentially in the last few years is retaliation. And what retaliation is, I have an employer. I believe that the employer's policy violates Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and I speak up about that, and as a result of that, the employer fires me. That's a case of retaliation. Now, the critical thing that I want you to be aware of is in retaliation cases, I think that the employer's policy is violative of Title VII. Suppose that I'm wrong, but the employer goes ahead and fires me. Can a case of retaliation still be made out even though the underlying cause has been shown to be doesn't exist? And the answer is yes. The retaliation claim is freestanding. So if an employer does something to an employee who is engaged in a protected activity, that's a retaliation claim. All right? The area that I want us to focus on perhaps more than any other is the accommodation aspect of religious discrimination. It is understood that the employees in the workplace may come from religious traditions. And because of that, those religious traditions, it is important for the employer to accommodate, make reasonable accommodations to the extent that the employer can, so long as it doesn't impose an undue hardship, there's the magic language, on the employer. So, I am a Muslim woman.
I'm not, but.
And I'm a faithful Muslim woman, so what do I wear? I wear a hijab. I wear a headscarf because that's what my faith teaches me. All right? Is the employer required to make a reasonable accommodation to that if they can? And the answer is, so long as it doesn't impose an undue hardship, the employer has that requirement. Now, about 30 years ago now, a Professor Merrill published a law review article about religious liberty in the workplace, and a sort of consensus was created, and that consensus has been in place for about 30 years now. And central to that consensus is this notion of accommodation. Let me just to mention, by the way, if you look at your website, I have posted an outline of some of these preliminary comments. and it's there for you to look at. But let's just look at some of the accommodations that might be required. Scheduling changes, voluntary substitutes, shift swaps, changing employees, job tasks, or providing a lateral transfer, making an exception to the dress and grooming rules, that's the hijab, use of the work facility for religious observance. I am a faithful Muslim. I pray five times a day. Can I request of my employer that he make available to me in the workplace a place where I can pray? That's could be a reasonable accommodation. Accommodations relating to payment of union dues or agency fees. Accommodating prayer, proselyting, and other forms of religious expression. All of these are accommodations, okay? And notice that the employer is required to make this accommodation so long as it doesn't impose an undue hardship on the employer. That's a very low standard, okay? So that's accommodation law. Now, I guess one of the things that I want to say to you is, I recently read an article. Let me just reference it for you. The Harvard Journal of Law and Gender published earlier this year a symposium on religious accommodation in the age of civil rights. And there's a professor at Harvard, his name is Mark Tushnet. And he wrote an article, Accommodation of Religion 30 Years On. What Tushnet argues in that article is that he believes that we need to rethink accommodation and either severely curtail accommodation or do away with it entirely. And he points out that both people on the right and left, well, that's confusing. People who are very much for civil rights are critical of accommodation, and people who are very intense with respect to religious liberties have their concerns about accommodation. And he thinks that in the cultural war that has been going on in this country and has now had its next chapter written with the Supreme Court decision of, 10 days ago, that we need to rethink and probably curtail or do away with accommodation. All right? So, now let me think if there's anything else that I wanted to, I think that's it. So, let me talk to you about, you may. Jim, go ahead.
Accommodation.
Accommodation.
What is, briefly, the rationale for wanting to do away with accommodation of one's religious beliefs?
He would return to, and think about the implications of this, Jim. What he wants to return to is strict separation of the religious sphere and the political sphere. And he thinks that, now, by the way, this grand bargain that was struck about 30 years ago, instead of strictly separating the religious sphere and the economic sphere or the political sphere, it provides an overlap. He argues that that overlap isn't going to work in the time when we're having these cultural wars with each other as a people, and that we should separate them out. But what's the implication of that? It's even more severe than that. The implication of that is that we leave to religion the religious sphere, and they are free to do in the religious sphere what they choose to do. And then we have over here the business sphere or the political sphere, and they do what they want to do there. It's not mentioned in the Tushnet article, but I'm going to add the subtext. The subtext is that religion has little or nothing to say in the political sphere. Okay? That would cause a rather dramatic change in how we think about employment and the workplace, if that were so. Please?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to what you were saying about the burden before you got to the stuff about Tushman. And you said that it was a very low bar. You said that an employer had to make accommodations under current law, less than post-employment undue burden. So what would constitute, what are some examples of something that would constitute an undue burden?
Okay. This goes all the way back. The great case was TWA versus Hardison, okay? Probably 40 years ago. And you had an individual who joined a religious faith, and his Sabbath was a Saturday. He now came to his employer, TWA, and said, I'm going to need a shift change. I'm working Saturdays, I no longer can work Saturdays. And the Supreme Court took the position that that would be an undue burden. Why? It would be an undue burden because TWA was a union shop, and in order to find somebody to replace this man on Saturdays would require somebody who had more seniority than this employee to change his schedule in order that this employee could work on Saturday so that this new person, well, this person who had now embraced this new religious faith could work on another day. That was an undue burden, all right? But I guess what I want to say to you is the undue burden can be satisfied much more easily under Title VII with respect to religious discrimination than the accommodation for disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which has a higher standard. Employers can usually say this is an undue burden. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the employer rarely can satisfy that burden under that act. So just be aware that, you know, we don't have one grand employment discrimination law. We have a series of employment discrimination laws. Our religion was part of the 1964 Act. At that time, we weren't prepared to say that age discrimination was a prohibited category. It subsequently was added in a separate act. We weren't prepared to say that disability was a category. We have now added that. And you probably are aware that there has been proposed legislation that would protect sexual orientation and gender identification. It's been in front of Congress for probably the better part of 10 years now. It has not been enacted to this point in time. With this recent Supreme Court decision, I wouldn't be surprised that it is enacted. So we would add another category of persons who we will protect under our discrimination laws. Should they all fit together rather seamlessly? They should, but they don't. Here is just one little example with respect to when accommodation is required. Title VII with respect to religion and the Americans with Disabilities Act have two different standards. Okay? Now, let me talk to you about the Abercrombie and Fitch case, all right? We have a young woman, I believe she was 18 years old at the time. She applied for a job with Abercrombie & Fitch in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Abercrombie & Fitch had a look policy. Abercrombie wanted their employees to project a certain image. And part of that look policy was that employees would not wear hats. But the term hat was not defined. All right? So, this young woman who is a Muslim applies for work at Abercrombie & Fitch, and she is interviewed by the person who conducts interviews at the Tulsa store. The woman notices that this young woman is wearing a headscarf. She conducts the interview. She says to this applicant, we have this look policy. She goes through the look policy with the employee. As far as I can determine from reading the case, this applicant makes no comment about the look policy and the hat. Probably because she thinks, I'm not wearing a hat. I'm wearing a headscarf, okay? But the interviewer then, after the interview, goes to the store manager and says, is a headscarf a hat? Do we have a problem here? The store manager says, beats me. I don't know whether we have a problem or not with this. Let's talk to the regional manager. It goes all the way up the chain to the regional manager, and the regional manager says, I think this runs afoul of our look policy. Don't accept this applicant. So the applicant is rejected. And after rejection, she's not happy about this, and she goes to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the administrative agency that handles employment discrimination cases under Title VII. The EEOC looks at the situation and says, this is a case of religious discrimination. She was rejected because she was wearing a headscarf. The employer should have accommodated this. The district court finds in favor of the young woman. The Federal Court of Appeals, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, reverses. It now goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in an 8-1 decision, in an 8-1 decision, holds that this is a case of employment discrimination under Title VII. Now notice, what the employer comes in and says, wait a minute, this is not discrimination. This is not discrimination because, number one, this was a neutral policy. All we say in our dress code is, you can't wear a hat. That can't be discrimination. And what Justice Scalia, writing for the court, says is, look, religion is a protected category, and because it's a protected category, it enjoys rights which trump neutral policies. The employer, being a smart employer, has not one argument, but a series of arguments. So the employer says, wait a minute, we didn't know that she was a Muslim. Okay? Now think about that for a minute, okay? Faithful Muslim women wear headscarves. Are they the only people in American society that wear headscarves? And the answer is no. People wear headscarves for a variety of reasons. They may wear headscarves because they think they're attractive. Their hair may be thinning, and therefore they wear a headscarf. There are a variety of reasons why people wear headscarves. We didn't know. And Justice Scalia says, nice try. I'm putting these words in his mouth. Justice Scalia says to them, look, the statute doesn't speak in terms of knowledge. It speaks in terms of motive. And clearly we can read into these facts that the fact she was wearing a headscarf was one of the motives behind your decision not to hire her. Okay? So, at the end of the day, the Supreme Court holds 8-1, with Justice Clarence Thomas, by the way, the single dissenter, holds that she has a cause of action and that this is a case of religious discrimination in the workplace. Well, I said I was going to do it in half an hour. Look at this. I've set some kind of record. I've done it in 27 minutes. Why am I leaving time for us to talk with each other? I'm leaving time with us to talk with each other for a variety of reasons. I want you to ask me questions. I've done a very quick walk through this. And something that I said may not have made any sense at all to you. And if that's so, I expect you to raise your hand and say, would you walk through that one more time a little more carefully with me? Or you may be somebody who has experienced religious discrimination in the workplace or know of someone who has experienced religious discrimination in the workplace, let's talk with each other about whether it is or is not religious discrimination. By the way, let me say to you that one of the reactions to the Abercrombie and Fitch case is the court answered a question, and in answering that question, created a dozen other questions. Okay? Now, just to show you, okay? Let me... here we go. Well, I am less... Let me tell you, because I read it several times. There is a web page out there. If you put in Abercrombie and Fitch, it'll come up. And there's this web page in which people are talking about the case backwards and forward. And one person says, look, this case is straightforward. It answers the questions. What Abercrombie and Fitch should do is lay out the policy, its look policy, and say to the young woman, do you have a problem with this policy? And she should say, yes, I have a problem with this policy. And then the employer should say, let's talk about an accommodation for your problem. And what we'll do is we'll talk with each other. By the way, she can suggest to me the accommodation she wants. I don't have to accept that. I can come up with something else. So long as mine is a reasonable accommodation, you have to be satisfied with it, okay? And there's no problem here. That's too simplistic. Okay, think about the facts of the case. What this says is your interviewer has to be an expert on religious discrimination law. Are most interviewers people who are experts on this? And the answer is no. Indeed, she wasn't. She went and talked to her store manager. Her store manager didn't know the answer either. So they went to the regional director of Abercrombie and Fitch to try to get an answer. Okay? Now, we don't know enough about the conversation here, but it's clear that the interviewer did say, look, we have this look policy. And this look policy talks about hats. But what Scalia is requiring is that you and I understand that the term hat covers scarves. Therefore, we start invoking the accommodation requirement and you and I talk with each other. How many people in an interviewing setting are going to be sophisticated enough to know that hat covers scarves? Okay? So can you see the kind of problems? And notice the other problem, Title VII, one of the things about Title VII is that we should not engage in stereotypes. All right? But after this Abercrombie and Fitch decision, every time I see a woman, and I'm an interviewer, every time I see a woman and she's wearing a scarf, what am I going to think? She might be a Muslim. Okay? Now, can I, under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, ask her, are you a Muslim? Forbidden. You have engaged in religious discrimination if you ask that question. So it does answer that you don't have to have knowledge, but it opens up a whole lot of other problems. So I guess the long and the short of this is, in our discussion with each other, if I don't have an answer for you that just is like that, don't be off-put by it. That's how employment workplace lawyers make a living, is tackling these kinds of questions and trying to come up with answers. And they come up with an answer on behalf of their client, whether it's the person who alleges religious discrimination or the employer, and then they go to a judge and a jury, and they decide, at the first level, and then it may go beyond that all the way up to the Supreme Court. Okay, so, yes?
I don't mean to interrupt. Many years ago, I was sitting in my office, got a call from a client in Wyoming, an industrial facility. He said, I have a problem. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has sent an inspection team up here, and they're threatening to shut us down because we won't let them go out into the plant. I said, why not? He said, one of them is a Sikh, S-I-K-H, and he will not remove his turban to put on a hard hat. Under company policy, Wyoming law, and federal law, no one can be out there without a hard hat. What do I do?
Okay, here is our first case study, my friends. The employer is required to make a reasonable accommodation. Now notice, this is not an employee case. This is even worse. Okay. We're gonna shut him down, but it's not an employee case. I'm gonna transpose this slightly and say, suppose this individual, rather than coming for the inspection, is somebody applying for work. He is a Sikh. He wears a turban. It's part of his religious apparel. And you say to him, well, here are the safety and security requirements. You need to wear a hard hat.
We even talked about, and this is, I'm not being facetious, what do you have in the plant that could do it? A wash tub? You know? Bucket, and none of that worked. I'll tell you the solution.
Well, let me just add for you, under Title VII, if this involves safety, then Title VII permits you to ignore the Sikh hat requirement. Okay? But, I want you to be counsel for this job applicant who's a Sikh, who wears a turban, and wants to wear a turban and not a hat. What argument are you going to make for him? The employer says, we can't do this. It will imperil safety. You might be injured. What's your response?
You tell him that he should sign a release from liability, and that will accommodate the employer, and he wouldn't have to wear a hard hat.
Okay, it
won't accommodate the feds.
I was just going to say.
I realize.
Okay, we're going to satisfy. Potentially, we're going to satisfy the applicant and the employer, but federal and state government officials are not going to be happy about this.
But the court may.
Go ahead.
That's actually not a bad idea. I have been in situations. I remember going into a mine with a fellow wearing a cowboy hat. He was a company manager. So what is that? Custom made. It met all the specs. It was a cowboy hat, a hard hat.
Okay. So maybe the reasonable accommodation here is, instead of the hard hat worn by all other employees, this particular Sikh employee is going to have a special hat. And the question is going to be whether it's an undue hardship for the employer to do that. By the way, you ask about administrative costs, these kinds of costs, all of those are the kinds of things you think about when you think about, is this an undue burden or not for the employer? And it might well turn, you know, Title VII covers employers of 15 or more. The answer if I'm an employer of 20 employees might be different than if I am an employer of 500 employees. So one answer does not fit all in terms of undue hardship. Okay, go ahead.
Let's say we're in San Francisco. We've got a restaurant. Among the employees in the restaurant are several very well-known gay LGBT advocates. It's important to the, to this restaurant owner that his people or her people work as a team. Teamwork is important. Along comes a very devout return missionary that applies for a position. In the interview, he's asked, what's your position on gay marriage? He says, I'm opposed. He said, we can't work here because we need team spirit. So my other employees would be upset to have an active Mormon on our staff. Does he have a case for not being accommodated his religion?
Okay, Don asked the question, does he have a case? And being you know, being the law professor, I turn around and say to you, does he have a case? Does he have a case? Go ahead.
Well, there were two recitations of the facts. The second recitation dealt with his religion. And the statement from the hiring person said, we can't have a Mormon here. Yes, he has a case. There's an argument. It's not necessarily true that he's going to win, but if the basis for refusing to consider an otherwise qualified applicant for a position in that restaurant is that he's Mormon, that could be a legitimate claim for religious discrimination.
Okay, now let's tie all of this together. I mean, the argument being made is, you know, we're here in San Francisco. It's very important that we have a team spirit among the employees working in this restaurant. And we already have, as employees, several people who are active in the LGBT community.
So does that become a bona fide job requirement or qualification that now, because there have been previous hires who are part of the LGBT community, that it's required that you be part of that community?
Well, I don't think it's required that you be part of the community, okay. But you're you're an ally.
Okay. That's unpersuasive.
Can you ask can the employer even ask the question?
The employer can't ask that question. Okay, so we've got to be careful a bit. But I'm sanitizing this, and I'm saying the employer's smart enough to say the only thing that the employer says is, you know, teamwork is very important for us here, and you know, this is San Francisco, and we have a municipal ordinance which protects people with sexual orientation. But by the way, there is no federal law, right? That's not a category that we yet have, but San Francisco has had a municipal ordinance.
And the state,
both have them, okay? And so, you know, We need camaraderie, and we just feel that you're an odd duck here. Okay? In your own setting, you might be just fine, but in this setting, you're an odd duck. Therefore, we're not going to hire you. Go ahead.
It feels like even in your sanitized version of this, that there's some very subliminal discrimination.
Go ahead. Tell me.
I'm not an attorney.
Listen. When my third let me tell you that I spent my life in the law. Do I think that the only people that have opinions in this area are people in law? No. And the legal profession is filled with some of the most arrogant people you can imagine. All right? So what are some of the subliminal things that are being...
Well, the implication is that because of his religious position or background or experience, he's incapable of working on a team that might have contrary views to his.
Good.
And that's in my opinion. I work in supply chain management, AltNet, and I've worked with contracts forever, thousands of them with attorneys. So I'm not completely blind to this, okay? I'm just not an attorney. But in my mind, there's no question that there are issues there with regards to discrimination.
Please.
I'm not attorney either, but...
Good. I'm so glad that we have lots of non-attorneys here.
But I'm a theater major. I can put this in a theater form. I'm going to stand on LGBT side because...
Please.
I want to talk about what they can do that we can have better understanding what they might do. If I were the San Francisco company owner, I would put on a subscription of what your job assignment ought to be. And then I would say very detailed, at certain point, certain action, I require you, doesn't matter if you have any faith or not, you have to accommodate that kind of group, quote unquote, spirit. And we won't use that word spirit, because I have to protect my right of using the language. That way, by telling anybody come to my work, I can smartly filter out who I don't want. I can detect you as a Mormon, detect you as a Muslim. I can say, oh, you don't fit my requirement, goodbye, that's it. That goes to the young woman's head or whatever, because they can ask her a simple question without asking if you're Muslim. You can ask, do you have to wear this every day? That will clear up if you want to talk about job opportunity or not, and she should know.
Now you just added a whole new dimension to this, which is lots of employers these days have diversity policies, right? We live in an age of diversity, and so this employer has a diversity policy. We're here in San Francisco. We have people from very diverse backgrounds, and here's our diversity policy, and our diversity policy requires you to sign that you will accept the people in this workplace. And let's assume that this is unfair, and I state to you it's unfair up front. Okay, so there's no confusion about this. But this is a young returned missionary who's just come back, and he's very fervent, and he refuses to sign the diversity statement on religious liberty grounds.
What does the statement say?
Yeah, you will accept everybody and anybody that we choose to hire in this workplace.
Accept meaning.
Good.
Description. You know, it's all detailed description.
Yeah, good.
Understand that word. I want to know what are you talking about before I say yes, I will submit. And oh, I will go to court. I will go invite Brother Wood to go to court with you. That's where attorney can make lots of money from this generation.
Let's not talk about making money, okay?
I want to.
Do the other team members accept him as part of the diversity policy?
Okay.
It adds a spice to the mix.
Because it's been posited that several of them are advocates for the LGBT community. And this very straight-laced Mormon who is not accepting of them. Remember, this is all hypothetical, my friends, but it's giving us a flavor for the challenges of religious liberty in the workplace when we have discrimination laws that prohibit. Mr. Adams wanted to say something here, so.
I actually practice in California. I've ever seen employers always include both religion and same-sex and every other protected category under the sun for the express purpose of saying to employees, you have to accept everybody that's coming into the workplace, and if you don't, you're out. And in this particular scenario, this young missionary is probably legitimately going to be fired in California because he needs to be accepted as a Mormon, and others need to be accepted for other protected category reasons.
Okay, please.
I was just thinking there's kind of a wide variation between, or seems like wide distance between maybe what the law is. I was kind of surprised by some of what you were outlining because I'm born and raised in California. We live in a really kind of liberal area of California. We've never not been asked if we're Mormon because it says BYU right on our residence. We've never not been asked. So I'm actually surprised that they're not allowed to ask. And my husband.
A lot of things happen that are not supposed to happen.
My husband worked for a college out there for quite a while, and two things that took place out there. One is that you, in education, don't have an option on your dues, your union dues. Your option is to have a job or not.
Yeah.
And the other thing was we had a picture in my husband's office. He had a photograph of. I mean, I could give you a list, but these three things. So, a photograph of us outside the temple on our wedding day, and he was told he had to take it down because it was hateful and offensive. And that if we had any pictures of us being married that did not support or promote any particular religious organization, then we would be able to have that, but otherwise we're not allowed to have it. So we had to take it off campus.
Okay.
Sad.
And I guess the answer, well, you might well have a religious discrimination lawsuit. I guess, notice the whole notion of religious discrimination is if the employee feels that there's a problem, the employee is supposed to go to the employer and say, look, I have a problem. I feel that a picture of me and my spouse in front of a religious edifice that isn't significant to us, but is not significant to you, is not hateful, and therefore I should be permitted to do it, particularly in view of the fact that other people can show other things where their marriage was celebrated, and that's not hateful.
Well, it was post Prop 8. We were just glad you got a job. It looked a little sketchy for a while.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
We've been talking a lot about keeping religion out of the workplace or being discriminated against for expressions of religion. We've had a couple of opportunities or incidents in Cincinnati where my husband and I live where it's a little bit the opposite of that. My husband works for a law firm that is traditionally very Catholic, and that's less true of younger associates and younger partners, but it's very true of the founding partners and some of that old guard. And when one of those founding partners retired, the firm hosted a Catholic ceremony in one of the conference rooms and invited all the attorneys to attend. I don't think it was a mass, but it was a religious ceremony of some significance. I don't think anybody complained about it. I think it was seen as, by those who are non-religious, as sort of quaint, and by those who are religious but non-Catholic as wonderful that there is an opportunity for this religious expression. So that was interesting. My husband is on the diversity committee because he's a Mormon. We think that's why we sort of represent
another point of view.
A non-Catholic views, even though he, as a white male, is not a traditional candidate for a diversity committee. There was another experience we had by a dear friend of ours, who's the CFO of a public corporation, and it came to light that an employee, a high-level employee, had been engaged in an extramarital affair with another high-level employee, and the question is what to do. And he was a devout Mormon, the CEOs were devout evangelicals, and much of the conversation about what to do in an employment context centered around the Christian principles of mercy and forgiveness and justice and how do we approach this workplace decision in the context of our Christian belief. And that played out for one party in that relationship very well, and for the other party was more offended and left the company. And the other was grateful for some of that. So that expressed itself in a different way, I think, than we see traditionally in these cases where religion is trying to be suppressed entirely.
Actually, I'm glad you brought this up because, you know, the overriding theme is of this conference is the need for civility and for a willingness to talk with each other. I don't know whether all of you noticed, but we had this terrible episode in Charleston, South Carolina, and a young man kills 8 or 9 people. And at the bail hearing, relatives of the people who were killed were allowed to come and to speak. And they came and expressed forgiveness and love. I was watching a news program about this, and the people were just dumbfounded that these people could do something like that. You know, they expected them to show up and be angry and vindictive and, drag this man through the streets and we will kill him in the most terrible way we can think. That was not their mood. And I guess what I'm saying to you is that, you know, there are going to be some bumpy times for people with respect to religious discrimination in the workplace and religious liberty in the workplace. I think our responsibility is to try to think of ways to work our way through that. I, for one, would not favor jettisoning the accommodation requirement because I think it requires the parties to sit down and talk with each other and say, okay, this is what I need. And for the employer to say, well, we can do that and go forward. Okay? Go ahead, Don.
Just a few minutes ago, BBC announced that the state legislature, with the approval of the governor of South Carolina, agreed to take down the Confederate flag in South Carolina. And I think this illustrates something else here, that a symbol that was kind of universally hated by most people and seen as divisive and hateful, certainly in the black community of South Carolina, that we didn't view it that way. Ultimately, perhaps it was the kindness and the reaction we've talked about that won over the hearts of the legislature, that's turned this idea down many times in the past, and the governors too. But now, they did it now. Ending a long,
I just want to add something here. It's passed the Senate. Now it has to go to the House.
I heard that it was a done deal.
I thought the third reading in the Senate requires three hearings, and the third reading was supposed to be today. Maybe it happened and it went over to the House, and the House was there, and the House said, boom, bingo. You had. Now, let me stop for a minute and say, just asterisk, now we're talking about public sector employees and employers, not private sector. And here, there is, you know, Title VII doesn't play out in the public sector. In the public sector, it's a First Amendment or the state law equivalent of the First Amendment that is the governing principle. You know, what that says is, do public employers have religious responsibilities under the First Amendment? Yes. Do public employees have rights under the First Amendment? And the answer to that is yes as well. But the question is here, you know, the police officer says, I feel uncomfortable performing my police duties in this gay pride parade.
It wasn't really a police duty, it was a performance. It was a performance.
Okay, a performance.
They weren't there protecting the public. I don't think he would have had an objection to that. What he was being asked to do was do a motorcycle demonstration with the police motorcycles down the parade route.
So that they were part of the parade. Okay. So what I want to ask you is, does, you know, this person was disciplined, was suspended, as I remember. Would he have had a claim that he's perfectly prepared to perform his police duty functions, but he doesn't want to become part of the parade? Which is, you know, comes back to, you know, the person who's in the business of making wedding cakes and says to the gay couple who shows up and, you know, they bought goods there, we're getting married and we want you to prepare a wedding cake for our marriage. And he or she says, I don't want to do that. I don't want to participate in your ceremony because I have moral scruples about it. By the way, the Oregon case I saw in the newspaper was decided, and a fine of $135,000 was placed on. And essentially, what appears to be evolving is the notion that if you go into the business of serving the public and making wedding cakes, you have to serve all customers who come to you asking for wedding cakes without exception. And it seems to me that the decision of last week with respect to same-sex marriage and making that a fundamental right gives even more oomph to this evolving position. But you're quite right, no accommodation discussion here, because it's not in the employment, it's not an employment case, it's in, you know, it's a consumer requesting a service.
Right, it's under the public accommodation.
It's under the public accommodation, and reading about yesterday's the sessions here, one of the people said, you know, we got through the Utah legislature, the two bills, we didn't get to public accommodations, and people were saying, well, are you going to do that this next session? And his response was, I'm tired. I don't know whether it's going to happen or not. Will that be a contentious issue? You better believe it. But that I'm your employment guy, okay? Not your consumer preference guy.
How does Title VII or any of this relate at all, or if any, to independent contractors? Is there any?
Typically, independent contractors are not viewed as employees. They're a separate category.
So what protections relates to religious discrimination, if any, do they have?
I must plead ignorance. Who can help us? Mr. Adams can. Good.
The current, at least in California, and I think more broadly across the nation, there's a current push by many agencies to suggest that many independent contractor relationships really aren't independent contractor relationships.
They're employees.
Strategy that's being used to suggest that protections that apply to employees should apply to these people because they're not really independent contractors. I know in misclassification cases in California are really a big deal right now.
They are a big deal everywhere.
Okay.
I'm sorry, my friends. We started on time, and I'm stopping on time because you have lunch at noon. But we have achieved my objective, which is you had lots of good questions, and I appreciate you making this conversation go. Mr. Ferguson?
Did we get the final on the...
Mr. Holtkamp, they want from you what resolution?
This, you don't learn this in law school.
You don't learn a lot of things in law school.
What do I do? They're going to shut us down. I said, you go back and say, my next phone call is going to be to the Denver Post. 10 minutes later, we called back and said, I said, what happened? They're on their way back to Denver. They're sending a new team.
Okay, so a solution, whether it's best solution, I leave that to you to decide. Have a nice lunch, my friends.
Last week I was in the United Nations, New York, of course. order?
Yes.
We're talking about what can we do as the right side to the left side. As I said, I'm a storyteller, a tailor. So I told the expert, I said, you know what we can do? Really, if this happens in communist country, China, you've got tons of story to tell. Because we are very good at making excuses inside of China. I'm from Taiwan, I'm China. So this is what my strategy would be. I said, what if I keep on telling the gay couple, oh, I would love to make cake with you. What does your cake need to be? And I'm going to describe this. This will cost certain ingredients. And I am going to order it from such and such country. It will take 2 months. Just keep on playing with time. And now the judge had fined this grandma how many thousand dollars. You know what we can do to help the cake maker? From now on, we can put a story. Gay marriage is such a unique product of our civilization. We are going to create certain type of cake to qualify the gay marriage couple, high quality. Therefore, the price will be up to $150,000. We're going to play it out as a business because business has the right of saying their own price tag. Now, this is very new to American people because American people are very law obedient. But in outside America, we tell tons of bizarre stories. You know what? American people put money to buy those bazaar. A little thing made just 5 cents of US dollars. American will pay $60, buy it, and brag about they bought it from Asia. You know, it's this kind of mentality. I'm willing to provide, to protect the right side, to say, you want to play? Let's play game with gay staff, because they're playing this game. We need to play their rule. If you keep on saying, oh, we have to be virtual, this and that, they say, of course I'm going to attack you. It's just my strategy. I know this is a lot to be discussed, but I just want to let you know.
Well, I guess what I'm going to say to you is clearly there's a cultural dimension. And what we have talked about in here is American society, constantly with this problem, how relevant.